Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is August 6th, 2004. Today's session number is KRK-2004-05. The speaker for today is Kevin Krause. The lesson for today is Human Genetics, Cancer Biology and Medicine. Let's listen in.
I teach biology at Luther College, and one of the things that I teach in cell biology is the subject of cancer. It's a fascinating area of cell biology, and as you know, it's really a collection of diseases that have some similarities. They have similar characteristics that I'll talk about today. But in this world that we live in, it's hard for anybody to avoid cancer, either for themselves, and some of you may have had or are working with cancer, but certainly for families and coworkers. I mean, a year doesn't go by where I don't know someone who develops cancer and then is working on it with physicians and other folks. So I think it's important to know a little bit about it, and that's why I teach about it. Cancer's really pretty simple in many ways. And we've learned a lot about it, probably because so many people deal with it. It's sort of true in human medicine. The common things we get good at working with many times because we have lots of practice. The rare things are more difficult for us because it takes us a while to learn how to treat things that go wrong. Cancer cells are characterized by two powerful yet simple characteristics. The first, I'll tell its story, all our cells in our body are under regulation. They have a rate at which they divide. For some cells, the rate is never. Our muscle cells. When we are born, we have all the muscle cells we're ever going to have. They grow. You can make them bigger by working them. And then as we get older, they tend to be not as strong, so we go through a change there, but we don't get more of them. Their precursors, early muscle cells, divided when we were embryos and created the muscles we have, but that's about it. The same with our neurons. There's a little bit of dividing of neurons after we're born for several months, but then that stops. And pretty much we have all the neurons we're ever going to have then. So they're not dividing. On the other hand, our skin cells divide. There's a population of cells underneath our skin in the dermis that divide for all our lives and provide this outer layer of, in fact, dead cells at the very edge that protect us. The same with cells that line our mouth, our esophagus, our gut. Those cells are dividing throughout our lives. Both the cells on the outside and on the inside where food goes through are subject to the environment. There's damage, there's loss, and it's good that we have replacements for them. So every cell has a cell division rate and that is controlled. Cancer cells have lost that control. If you want to think of the body as having an ecology where all the cells have their job and are working together so that life goes well, cancer cells have dropped the program and now they're in it for themselves. They're just going to divide, and whatever happens, happens. They're not worried about it. They've become selfish, in a way. The other characteristic of cancer cells is that most of our cells, those that aren't cancerous cells, are happy where they're at. So a liver cell does really well in the liver. If you were to take a liver cell and move it, say, to a bone or to a muscle or to your brain, shortly it would die. It doesn't understand where it's at, and it can't go on. So the way we understand this working now is, and I'll draw a few cells here in a group. So this is a group of cells. It could be in an epithelial layer. They all have a plasma membrane, a boundary. And associated with that boundary are lots of proteins that stick across to the outside and are on the inside. And we call these, some of them are receptors. Cells living in a group have receptors that touch each other across cell boundaries. And one of the things that they do is kind of affirm that, okay, you're here and you're with me and we're in the right place. They're talking to each other. Cells communicate. But those receptors are different in different places of the body. So if you take a cell from right here and move it over to here where these cells have different receptors, now this new cell has its receptors, but these can't interact. They don't have ways of interacting at the molecular level. And so that new cell feels lost. As someone who grew up in rural Minnesota might feel lost when they go to New York City for the first time. We deal with that usually, but cells can't. They die. Cancer cells have lost that inhibition of having to be in their home place. So not only can they divide as rapidly as they want to, but they can live other places. And that's a very unusual characteristic. It seems like a simple thing, but that's a very unusual characteristic. If the first happens, if a cell loses its division regulation, but it doesn't gain the capability to live elsewhere, you have what is known as a benign tumor. So the cell divides and divides, and you get this lump of cells growing in that place. But it doesn't ever move, or they refer to that as metastasize. It doesn't ever metastasize. Or if a cell leaves and goes someplace else, it dies. That's not cancer. Cancer is only both of those things, the ability to divide at a high rate and the ability to do well in other places. Okay, so it takes both of those. And really, it is the study of cancer that's taught us those things about normal cells, that normal cells have control over their cell division and control over where they live. We wouldn't really know that without studying cancer cells. So the study of abnormal has taught us about normal and what normal is. It turns out that both of those basic characteristics of cancer cells, both the ability to divide at a high rate and the ability to live someplace else, are regulated by several genes. Several genes are keeping things the way they're supposed to be, usually. In other words, to become cancerous, a cell has to accumulate several mutations. So cancer is not caused by a single mutation, or two, or even three. In most cancers that we understand very well, and we don't understand all of them very well, it takes 5 to 10 mutations at the least, and in many cases more like 10 to 20. Now, some of the evidence that first started to suggest that, as we started being better at diagnosing cancers and studying them and keeping track of things and counting things and communicating with each other across the world, it became clear that cancer is really a disease that comes more frequently as you get older. Okay, so if you graph the incidence of cancer versus age, the slope gets steeper and steeper with age. And what that suggested to people was something was accumulating. It took time. And that is mutations are accumulating. You wind up having more and more of them the older you get. It makes sense. So that was one of the things that taught us that lots of mutations are happening. Now that we can look at individual genes, this has been confirmed. That it's many mutations, and those many mutations have to happen in a single cell. It's a single cell that gives rise to cancers in humans. What that suggests is that many of our cells have mutations all the time. They don't lead to cancer. Okay, this was something that I thought was interesting and something I wouldn't have thought of when I first learned this when I was a graduate student, that mutation is fairly common. Many mutations don't lead to any problem at all. Sometimes a mutation kills a cell. Well, that cell dies and it's gone and there's others to replace it. Does it cause a problem? It's the rare cell that's able to accumulate these mutations and not die that becomes cancerous. So it's really a freak event. But once it happens, it's a very, very, very powerful cell. And we've learned that because now we're in the business of trying to kill those cells. And we've gotten better and better at that. We probably treat many cancers much, much better than we did even 20 years ago. But it's difficult to kill them. Okay, so that's a very brief introduction to the basics of cancer biology. What questions do you have about that kind of stuff? Yes, Dorothy?
Define mutation.
Okay. A mutation is a change in a DNA sequence, in a gene sequence. So when I say sequence, what does that mean? The basic structure of DNA at its very simplest level is that it is a sequence of molecules that are referred to as bases, and that's just a chemical reference. There are four of them: guanine, adenine, thymine, and cytosine. So the very first biochemists who studied DNA told us in the 1940s that those were the four nitrogenous bases, and that DNA is a sequence of these bases, and genes consist of a stretch of these bases. So the sequence is completely random. In other words, there's no pre-patterning. So a gene sequence could be A. It could be all A's. Or it could be several A's, then a T, then a C, then an A again, etc. That information, so all of our genetic information is in this sequence, that information is used to create, if this is one single gene here, this sequence is used to make a sequence of amino acids in a protein. Okay, so the protein myosin, which is a muscle protein, has a particular amino acid sequence. And if I saw what that amino acid sequence was, I could tell you what the DNA sequence was, because there's a code, the genetic code that's used. Well, if say this is the sequence for myosin, AAATCA, and it'd be much longer than that, but if there was a mistake such that this A changed to a G, that would cause a problem with the protein. The protein's amino acid sequence would be different, and the protein wouldn't work the same way as it usually does. So mutations in genes are changes in the DNA sequence. We've learned a lot. Yes?
What's the catalyst for this change?
Well, I was just going to start talking about that. We've learned a lot. That was a very good cue. We've learned a lot about how DNA sequence changes, and there's lots of different ways. Powerful energy, such as ultraviolet light or X-rays or nuclear radiation, can damage the sequence. It can cause a hole to be blown, and a base can be removed because of energy that hits DNA. Now, you know, DNA is inside a cell. It's protected somewhat. But we expose ourselves and each other to this kind of energy at certain times. We expose ourselves to UV light when we go out in the sun and don't cover up. We expose ourselves to X-rays very often for medical reasons. We want to be able to do an X-ray, and so we expose ourselves. We try to protect ourselves somewhat, but we're letting it have that chance. You can either blow a hole in it, in which case there's missing, or it can cause chemical changes. In fact, these four bases are similar enough to one another that sometimes energy can cause a T to change to a G by knocking one atom off of it or adding one. We also have some chemicals in the body look like those four bases, and the machinery that builds DNA sometimes makes a mistake and puts something else in here that looks like one of the others, and that can cause problems later on. Whenever a cell divides, before it divides, it has to replicate its DNA. It has to make a second copy of the DNA, so that the two daughter cells will each have a copy. It turns out that the machinery that replicates DNA in our bodies does a pretty good job most of the time, but once in a while it makes a mistake and it puts the wrong base in. Okay, nature's not perfect. It's a hard thing to believe, but once in a while. And so that's happening too. We're actually making mistakes. So some of the mistakes are inherent in the machinery. And in fact, there's a proofreading machinery that comes along afterwards and checks for mistakes. And sometimes it fixes them, but it's not perfect either. We learned a lot about that by studying bacteria and DNA's bacteria, or the bacteria that's in DNA. It also gets replicated and proofread, and there's mistakes there as well. So by studying smaller organisms, you know, and bombarding them with mutagens and then looking to see what happened, we learned this, and then we found out it's the same in ourselves as well. So when you get replicated, when your cells replicate, there can be mistakes. Exposure to certain chemicals, exposure to certain energies can cause mistakes as well. Yes?
Is it still viruses, the viral attacks, do they feel that's really big on this?
Viruses can cause mistakes because some viruses insert themselves into chromosomes. Part of a viral strategy to get itself made lots of copies of that virus is that they will insert their DNA, so a whole new sequence gets put in here. Well, if that happens to be in the middle of a gene, that's a huge mistake. That's a huge mutation when a virus inserts. Yeah. Yes?
I was wondering if you were familiar. I was reading some papers by a German, I think he was a German chemist, who was talking about oxygenation of the cells and fermentation of the cells.
I wonder if
you were familiar with that theory.
Chemical processes that create molecules known as free radicals. Free radicals are reactive chemicals, and if you build up enough of them in your cells, sometimes your DNA can get attacked by your own cells. We have, again, machinery in the cells whose job it is to get rid of free radicals, reactive chemicals, but sometimes they do their work. So the cell can actually cause mutations on its own that way as well. Yes, sir.
Can you explain the relationship between PSA and prostate cancer?
PSA is an acronym for prostate-specific antigen. It's a protein made in the prostate normally. And so all the prostate cells are making this protein, and so there's a certain level of it that we know is normal. When cells are cancerous and they're growing at a fast rate, they make more PSA. And so you have an elevated protein level, and we can check for that fairly simply.
Does it tell you anything about where the cancer is or anything?
It's in prostate cells, but no, it doesn't say where in the prostate.
And it can be any place. It can be in the bones. It can be any place.
If it's spread to someplace else, it could be, yes. So you'd have to do further tests. So the PSA, the simple test, is just to say how much of it is there. If there's more than normal, then something's not right. But they don't know the extent to which the not right is. You know, has it really spread? Where has it spread? Those are other questions that, you know, now you have to bring in things like MRIs to take a look. Look for spots. Okay, so mutation leads to changes, and if you have enough changes in the right genes, you can get this cell that divides as fast as it wants to and can live anywhere in the body, and that's a problem. It's a problem because when you have multiple tumors that are all dividing very quickly, it's very simple again. They're using up the energy. They're taking energy away from normal activities, and eventually that can kill you. You have essentially this other group of cells that doesn't care about the ecology of the body that can kill you. It also can kill you if that tumor is growing in a major blood vessel, blocking blood flow. It can kill you if it's growing in a major organ, if it disrupts the functioning of that organ, whether it be the brain or the heart or the liver. So it's really fairly simple at the biological level what's going on, and fairly devastating as well. Yes?
Why don't they think that the immune system cells actually can see the cancer? That's got to...
Yeah, well, what the immune system sees about cells is the surface and these proteins that stick across. And when we're very young, in fact, as embryos, our immune system identifies what our cells look like in terms of the proteins. Some cancer cells don't change enough about their plasma membrane so that they can be recognized. We know now that the immune system does recognize some cancer cells and get rid of them, but it's not perfect. And so some cancer cells escape the surveillance of the immune system and get away, and the immune system can't keep up at some point.
Could it be that the immune cells and the cancer cells are both hitting the same range of defects?
Right, and sometimes the immune system cells can be the cancer cells. Yeah. And so things get confused. So, as we look at human cancers and what do we call it, the epidemiology of it, people who study human cancers as a group, and we've learned a lot that way as well. So not only did we learn that as you get older, your chances of cancer increase, we also now know that your exposure to certain chemicals can also increase it. And this knowledge has come about because of bad things that happened. There was a factory in England in the 1950s that started using a new chemical, a type of naphthalene. I forget the whole name of it, but it was a naphthalene. And after 10 years, everybody who worked with that chemical got bladder cancer at that factory. And so, that one causes mutations in bladder cells, and we've got to stop using it. And we did, but lots of people had to suffer before we knew that. And we're pretty good at making new chemicals. Especially, and I don't know if I'm showing too many biases here, but especially at times of war, we work really hard at making new chemicals. At least we did in the last century. Things we can use as nerve gases and bombs and things like that. The chemistry at the university level, research level, gets a big boost, or it did at World War I and World War II and Korean War, because we gave them lots of money to come up with things that we could use as weapons. And so later things were used in industry and stuff like that, and we found out that not all those chemicals were good for us over the long haul, that exposure to them over years led to enough mutations and could cause cancer. And so we're on the lookout for that sort of thing. We test chemicals as they're derived. I was reading one of the magazines out here that said last year the FDA approved 21 new drugs. The year before, in the 1990s, the average was 30 per year. And so we test them. We test them on rats and mice. Problem with rats and mice: they don't usually get cancer. They don't live long enough. And so they're not the best organisms to be testing. They're not as similar to us as we would like them to be in terms of testing for cancer. But that's all we have, so that's where we do the tests. So that's a little bit tricky. Other questions? I got lots more I can talk about, but just catch people up. Yep?
The heredity of cancer.
Yeah, this gets into the genetics, and it's not an inherited disease. You cannot inherit cancer. No one has that many mutations together in a cell that get inherited. What you can get is a predisposition to cancer, and we see that in families. A higher rate of cancer in particular families, having, as far as we can tell, nothing to do with the environment that they're living in some cases. And that suggests an inherited predisposition, and I'll talk about that. So, as we look at what cells give rise to cancer in the body, you can find nearly any cell type give rise to a cancer. But it's much more frequent in some cell types than others. Muscle cells very rarely give rise to cancers. There are a few. What are the cells that give rise to cancers the most? The outside and the inside, where things are traveling through. So, skin cancers, esophageal, cancers of the mouth, stomach cancer, colon cancer, things where there's lots of damage and lots of cell replication. Leukemias are up there as well. Bone marrow cells that divide to give rise to red blood cells and white blood cells. It's interesting to look at the environmental effect. People counted up the incidence of cancers and and studied this and found that in Japan, one of the highest cancers is stomach cancer. In the United States, stomach cancer really pretty low compared to some of the others. In the United States, breast cancer fairly high. In Japan, breast cancer very low. What does this mean? Is it something in the environment in Japan that gives rise to the stomach cancer and we don't have that exposure here? And vice versa for breast cancer? Or does it have something to do with the genetics of the populations? Japan is not a very diverse genetic pool. Most of the people that are there now have descended from a fairly small group. United States, is that true? Not at all. I mean, this is a country of immigrants, essentially. We're a few generations away from the biggest immigrations of the 1800s. But people who live in this country come from all over. Well, then maybe you need to break it down by ethnic groups in this country. And when you do that, the cancer rates are still about the same in terms of the stomach and breast. So that's not the answer. Well, the environments are certainly different. We eat different foods to some extent, different air qualities, things like that. The answer came when someone figured out, well, but wait a minute, there's people who have lived in the United States for a while and moved to Japan, and people who've lived for a while in Japan and then moved to the United States. What do we see there? It's fascinating. People who maybe grew up, spent 20 years in Japan and then moved to the United States have a higher breast cancer rate and a lower stomach cancer rate. And people who spent a long time in this country and then moved there, their stomach cancer rate goes up, their breast cancer rate goes down. It's the environment. That's a very strong suggestion that it's the environment in those cases that is the key factor. What is it in the environment? We don't know. People think about that and are working on that, studying that, but that's a tough question to answer simply and in a short time. But that's the sort of thing that we're starting to be able to do with databases and communication between countries and better techniques for detecting and diagnosing cancers. We're starting to be able to look at the epidemiology a little bit and point our fingers at factors. We've also gotten much, much better at treating cancers. And this is probably apparent, some of them anyway. Many cancers can be dealt with early with surgery to remove that original group of cells. You know that if you have cancer to remove a tumor and it's the only tumor that you have, that we say, well, we need to check for about 5 years. Keep checking it. Because we really have no idea whether a single cell metastasized someplace else in the body and is sitting there getting established and is starting a tumor. A tumor has probably got on the order of 100 million cells in it. So it takes a while for a tumor to form. And once a tumor forms, there's probably been chance for movement. And so you hear surgeons say, well, we got all the tumor, we think we've got it all. I'm not sure whether there's been any metastasis, I don't think so, but that's really hard to tell. So surgery is a possibility. We've also started in the last 30 years to develop chemicals that we can throw at these tumors and cause them to die or shrivel up, go into remission. There's a myriad of chemicals. Most of them have the basic characteristic of killing cells that are dividing at a fast rate, once we figured out that's what was going on. The problem, as you know, is that we have normal cells that are dividing at a fast rate as well. And so our hair falls out, because those skin cells that make hair cells or that make hair are dividing at a fast rate, and they are susceptible to chemotherapy. The digestive tract gets hit hard, and so we have nausea, loss of weight. We can't process food like we normally would. And, the medical community refers to this as trying to do everything it can to kill the tumor without killing the body, but getting very close to killing the body in some cases. If you can get, the closer you can get to that, the better you're doing, as long as you don't go over that line. So these are very, very harsh chemicals for dividing cells. There's a constant search for new chemicals. We're grinding up almost every plant we can think of, and people travel to the Amazon jungle and to the tops of mountains looking for new plants and bring them back to labs, grind them up, extract and purify different chemicals, and then throw them at tumor cells that we have growing in petri dishes. And once in a while, we get a hit. Tamoxifen, used in breast cancer treatment. It's derived from the yew tree, and that's exactly how it was found. There was no indication that this yew tree had a chemical that would fight cancer cells. It was just somebody looking to see if maybe there was something. And it worked. And that's a great thing for people with breast cancer. But we're still looking. We don't have, you know, the magic bullets yet. We think about gene therapy and we play with it a little bit. We work at it. It's not a widely used technique yet. But there's a big hope that we'll be able to, you know, stop some cancers with gene therapy by providing a gene. Questions now, at this point.
What does radiation therapy do?
Radiation is pinpointed in many cases at the tumor to destroy those cells if possible. So that's a non-chemical but high energy. And very often other cells around will get some damage as well, but they're getting more and more accurate with those beams of radiation. And so that can be, you know, devastating to those cells. And if you miss the normal cells around, that can be a good thing. We can do whole body types of chemotherapy, you know, and really knock out a lot of cells. Sometimes then the bone marrow gets killed. So the treatment can be severe enough that you lose your population of dividing cells in the middle of your long bones. And then you know that we have bone marrow transplants to try to replace those. And we've gotten much, much better at bone marrow transplants in the last 20 years. We're much better at figuring out how to make those stick and how to work with bone marrow transplants from people that aren't close relatives. We've been able to move further and further away there. Very often that means immune suppression of the people that are getting that bone marrow transplant. Yes, ma'am?
So the question I have is, don't they sometimes now have people sort of extract their bone marrow before the chemotherapy?
Yes.
So they know it's going to be destroyed, and so they can put
it back
later?
Yep, some medical centers are very good at that, at storing that bone marrow and keeping it alive and then putting it back in when there's no chance of finding somebody. That weakens you when you take that bone marrow out to begin with. And what about cancerous cells that are in there? And so there can be side effects there. So it's a bit of a trick. What did we learn about the genes that are involved? You asked a question earlier about those. It's been fascinating, and at this point there are over 100 genes that are known to commonly be involved in cancer cells. These are referred to as oncogenes. And they fall into different categories. One category is a group of genes whose job it is in all of our cells to say to the cell, it's time to divide. You've got to start dividing. Replicate your DNA, make more mitochondria. If you're a plant cell, make more chloroplast, but you've got to get ready to divide. So these are genes that push the cell toward division. It turns out that you can have mutations of those genes that don't inactivate the gene. And when I first hear the word mutation, I think knocked out, dead. It turns out that mutation can go the other way as well. You can change a base in a sequence, and the protein that's made from that gene is a super protein. It does better than normal. And so a gene whose job it is to normally tell the cell to divide. Now, I've got a signal coming from the outside. Say you're a progenitor for red blood cells. There's a signal that comes that says, there's been a wound, we lost some blood, you've got to divide, we've got to make more red blood cells. Turns out there's mutations that can lead to leukemia that are false, that cause the cell to say, oh, there's been blood loss, I need to, when there hasn't been. And so the red blood cell machine starts cranking up because of this mutation. And there's more division than there should be. And that can be the start down the road to cancer, because now the cell's dividing more rapidly than normal, and there's more mutations that can happen because of mistakes in replication. And those mutations can add to the growing list of genes that are mutant. So mutations in genes whose job it is to push the cell through division are biggies in the oncogene world. If you've got one of those going, it's hard to treat that with gene therapy. It's a positive signal for division. It's hard to get rid of that. Turns out that all cells also have a group of genes whose job it is to say, don't divide. It's not time to divide. Just sit here, do your thing, hang out, but it's not time to divide. They are brakes on the machinery of cell division. These are referred to as tumor suppressor genes. If you think about it, to lose the control of cell division, you need these proteins that are saying divide, 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 and you need to lose both copies, both the one you got from your mother and the one that you got from your father, of your tumor suppressor. In most of the tumors that we've studied and really looked at the genetics, both copies of the tumor suppressor gene have been mutated to a loss of activity, and they are dead, and the brakes are gone. So not only are you getting a push down the hill, but the brakes are gone. Tumor suppressors would be a target for gene therapy if you could add back good copies. The problem is, when you've got a tumor with 100 million cells in it, how are you going to do gene therapy on 100 million cells? What you could look for are people who are missing tumor suppressor genes very early on in their life. These are the inherited situations. What you can inherit is a mutated tumor suppressor genes, and people do that. We have families around the world who have bad copies of the tumor suppressor gene in their genetic population, their pool, and they are predisposed to cancer. It is more likely that they will develop cancer. We see that in those families because they have multiple childhood cancers. Childhood cancer is fairly rare. You haven't had time to accumulate. But if you inherit bad copies of tumor suppressors, childhood cancer is more likely. So we've learned a little bit about that. There's an inherited childhood cancer called retinoblastoma. It's an inherited predisposition. It's an eye cancer. And so we learned about tumor suppressor genes there first. And people are working on those. So, you know, you get a few of these, you lose both your tumor suppressors, and you gain one that's pushing you, and now you're creating lots of cells. And if they accumulate other mutations, now they're able to metastasize. Other mutations that involve metastasis are proteins that allow a cell to crawl out of its normal environment, dissolve its way through membranes around organelles, and set up shop other places. We don't know as much about those yet, but we're studying those. What are the genes that allow cells to travel and move to a different place and do well? That's a big question, and very few of them have been identified, but people are working on that. Other questions? Yes, sir.
Could the genes, when they did the genome project and they had the unknown stuff, they said, hey, what's all that junk gene? First they called it the junk gene. What, could those be involved in this cancer thing?
Sure, yeah.
It's like past evolution coming into...
We need to study all these new genes that have just been discovered. And many of them, I'm sure as people study them, they're thinking about cancer as they do that, and wondering how this protein might be involved.
It's almost like a salamander growing a new arm. Some of those genes might be stuck in that.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yes, sir.
Where are some of the good research coming? How is it coming about? Is it through pure science, where you're doing research on things that biologists and biochemists do, or is it in where they've got a big grant and they're directed a narrow scope of research, say, to find something out about cancer, because pure science can lead to bigger
discoveries.
I don't know what the answer is.
Both are important. We need to just study living cells and learn as much as we can about them and about how they divide and how they don't divide and how their receptors on their cell surface help them feel comfortable. So we need that kind of research, whether it's on fruit flies or yeast or mice or frogs. But we also need directed study of humans who have cancers. And we need them to donate DNA and have us look at that DNA. And we need, and you know, this isn't a fun part of this, but we need people who are in the last stages of their lives with cancer to try new drugs and things like that. I mean, I've never had to be in that situation. I hope I'm not. It seems, you know, horrible. But we've learned a lot through those sorts of things.
Isn't it difficult to get funding for pure science versus a directed type science?
Yeah, it is. It's harder to get that money. The National Institutes of Health, a government agency that gets billions of dollars every year, our taxpayer money, has a directive to study health-related issues. And so big grants go to people at the universities. The National Science Foundation, another government agency that gets much less money, studies everything, you know, the geology, the agriculture, and the basic molecules and the basic functions of life. So most of the basic, not applied research is happening out of NSF. Well, NSF gets much less money than NIH every year, and there's a strong push that if you write a grant to NSF that you say how it might be applied. And so it's getting harder and harder for people to just ask simple questions about the world that is around us. Researchers are having to say how this applies to cancer or AIDS or other things. And that's a little bit unfortunate, but when money's short, tough decisions have to be made, and that's why we elect people and things like that. Yep. Yes, Gary?
I don't understand how gene insertion mechanically works. Does it, and my mind tells me there's no way you can do that for the billions of cells that are in your
body. No, you can't. You can't. You have to be able to do it to cells that are going to give rise to billions of cells, that are going to divide enough so that they can be a meaningful population. And it's tricky, but viruses are the way, because viruses have ways of inserting themselves into our chromosomes, inserting their DNA into our chromosomes. They have DNA sequences that can pop in. And that's putting it very simply, but they have ways of cutting the DNA and pasting themselves in. It's a fascinating aspect of virology, and that one that we've had to study because viruses attack us. That's the only reason we know this. So it's tricky. Yes, ma'am?
Yeah, this question stems from the comment that you made just before this last comment. How much of the drive to research or to study cancer is political? That question is making sense. How much of the drive to research cancer is political?
Yeah, I don't have an exact percentage, but it's an important driver, as well as you know, the twin question: how much of it is economic? And it's a very powerful push. Several years ago, people pointed out to NIH that we were doing a crummy job of studying women's health in this country; that there was a preponderance of research about males and male diseases. And NIH has responded. And, you know, how it happens that we don't notice this happening as it's happening maybe suggests that there are too many men in charge, or, you know, they're not paying attention, those that are in charge. But political pressure is important. It's important in everything in this country. Where the money goes depends on who's at the state capitals and who's in Washington, D.C., and how good they are at making their arguments, and how well connected they are. It's not the perfect world, but it's where we're at. There's another whole aspect to this, and some of it's things that we've brought up in other sessions this week, but what about the treatment for cancer and how much it costs on an individual basis, and how much it costs our society, and How does an individual decide when they're going to fight and when they're going to back off of fighting a particular disease and opt maybe for a higher quality of life but a shorter life? How do we make those decisions? How do hospitals decide, you know, who should get treatment? Only those who are insured? Only those in which there'll be money to pay for this? Or everybody? Another interesting aspect of this, and people have been studying this for a few years, but there needs to be a lot more work, but in fighting diseases like cancer, which is essentially a disease from the inside, it's not an infection. It's not a car accident, but how much does our mental state, our attitude, maybe our faith grounding and belief in a God, how much does that come into this? You know, what's the connection between our brain and our thinking and our immune system and our ability to fight disease? Yes?
When chromosomes divide, they're just full of mitochondria. They're full of mitochondria, and the mitochondria have the RNA in them. Is there been a lot of research to discover how the mitochondria is unraveling the DNA as a differentiation?
People try to work on that, but it's difficult.
For example, if a virus attacked the mitochondria, which is the power of the cell, you would have a...
Yeah, the whole chromosome structure, you know, I write it as a sequence. In fact, it's all wrapped up in this big tangle, like spaghetti, or a big ball of string that's been messed up, and that's inside of each of our cells. And we know much less about the three-dimensional structure of DNA and chromosomes and how that affects gene expression and differentiation of cells than we know about the single sequence. We know about that, but we don't know about a lot.
I'm expecting that the junk DNA probably has a lot of connection to the mitochondria RNA.
Yeah, maybe, yep.
To get the three-dimensional thing going.
Mm-hmm. We're very, very, very early in our study of human genetics and DNA. There's probably lots of things that we will find out in the next 50 years that are important. And there's probably things that we think are true today that are not. I try to explain that to students gently when I talk to college students. And I say, you know, you got this textbook here, and I say to read it, and I talk and tell you what we know, and a lot of this is true. But not all of it. And we don't know what isn't true. And, you know, and they'll say, well, no, okay, now that's fine, but with regards to the test, and what I put down as my answers is, could all that be right, no matter that, even if it contradicts the book? And we got to draw the line someplace. But, you know, we look back at what people thought they knew 100 years ago, and sometimes we say, gee whiz, you know, what were they thinking? And in 100 years, people look back at us and say the same sort of things. And the fact is, everybody's doing the best they can. We're learning as fast as we can about the world around us and ourselves, but we'll make some mistakes. We just have to keep being open-minded about how we look at things, and it'll work out. You know, people used to think the world was flat. We used to think that the Earth or that the sun revolved around the Earth. We were sure it did. Turns out once we got better information, we changed the story.
In the beginning, you mentioned there's been differences between the U.S. and, say, Japan, a certain kind of cancer.
Yes.
Is there any differences significant in the U.S. itself?
Yeah, there are. I don't have any of those maps with me now, but epidemiologists have produced those. You can look at a map of the United States and find places where cancer rates are much higher than other places. And you can find places where certain cancers from particular organs are higher than others. Again, when people have looked at it, sometimes there's an ethnic source there, if there's a small enough, tight enough population, but usually it's environment. It's exposure to certain chemicals, either that are in the earth there in that place, or are being used in industry in that place. And people in large numbers are working in that industry.
And so, yes, absolutely. It's like we know that lung cancer and smoking go together, too. We've learned that. Does it always go together every time? Well, no. Not every smoker gets cancer, lung cancer. Not everybody who has lung cancer is a smoker. But there's a connection, a high connection. Have we banned smoking? Have we made it illegal? No. That's a harder thing for us to do than knowing that it's bad. It's harder for us to say we will not make cigarettes, sell cigarettes, or use cigarettes. Maybe that's one of the things that people will look back in 100 years and say, gee whiz, they were slow on that. But it's tricky. It's very tricky. Yes?
Are there some racial discrepancies in terms
of... There may be, but I don't have those data. And, you know, I kind of tie racial and ethnic. It makes sense that if you have a small enough, tight enough group that hasn't intermarried, there can be some differences to, you know, either less susceptible to certain cancers or more susceptible. But it really doesn't have anything to do with the fact that it's ethnic. It was just a smaller gene pool in that group. Less diversity there at the genetic level. But I don't know.
So you would really say that genetics plays a much smaller role than the environment in terms of cancer?
Inheritance doesn't play a big role. No, environment is much more important. Yep. Viruses don't play a big role. For a while we were really worried about viruses and cancer. There are very, very, very few cancers that are tied to viruses. There are just a couple. So far, I mean, there are probably new viruses being born every day. Viruses can cause trouble in an individual gene when they jump into that gene and knock it out. So there could be an involvement that way. And certainly there's higher amounts of certain cancers in AIDS patients, but it's not the AIDS that's necessarily causing it directly. Yes, ma'am?
Could you talk a little bit about the role of food in either increasing cancer or foods that make you less susceptible to cancer? What's the mechanism that's going on there in either direction?
Well, it's just cell biochemistry. And we don't know a lot of the answers there, but everything we bring in brings with it molecules and chemicals. So it makes sense that we could take in, eat things that would be damaging, or things that would boost our immune system or be protective of cells. But we don't have a lot of clear answers right now. I mean, there's kind of a fad going on in this country about omega-3 fatty acids that they protect against cancer. Not enough data yet to say for sure that that's going on. And I haven't heard of any particular food that's been absolutely tied just itself to mutation rates, but it may be that someday we will. I mean, the stuff about living in different countries and having different cancer rates, it could be food. It could be in the air, it could be in the soil, it could be in the food. Yeah. Yes, ma'am, behind me.
So I assume that the incidence of cancer has been going up over, let's say, the last 100 years. If that's the case, how much do they tie it to people living longer and how much to the environment worsening?
Yeah, that's not clear either, but both things are thought to be playing a role. So as a rule, because of better medicine, better nutrition, better safety, more people live longer. And therefore, there's more incidence of cancer just because of that. And we're using more chemicals, and so the cancer rate has probably gone up some. But what percentage it's gone up due to each of those factors, I don't know.
Is there a window when as you grow older, that you're more susceptible? Like after you're 60, your incidence is...
Not that I've heard of, no.
Okay, just no. As you age.
Yeah. And you're aging because you're accumulating mutations that have happened all your life. Uh-huh. All your life. Now, it's probably true that our correction systems slow down as we get older, just like our immune system does, just like our muscle system does. But I don't know the exact answers there.
Of course, we don't know.
Yes, sir.
This one's a couple-part question. I heard something about like heating food in styrofoam in the microwave.
Wow.
Like, does that cause or help mutate?
I'm not sure.
Okay, microwaves themselves.
Yeah. You know, when you hear things like that or read about them in the newspaper, what's really nice is if you can get to a scientific paper that is involved and read that and look at the experiments that people did and find out where the data comes from. And that takes time, and it takes searching. And so it's not easy for everybody to do that with everything they hear or read about in the newspaper. Or talk to somebody, and I suppose you're trying to right now, but I don't know the answer. And the internet certainly has made this sort of thing easier. But then again, you can't and wouldn't want to believe everything you read on the internet. But there is a website at the National Institutes of Health. I think what you do, if you Google PubMed, you'll get to the NIH's library. And what you'll be able to do is search on that library for something. You could put in cancer styrofoam microwave. And what you would get is a list of articles that talk about the involvement of microwaving styrofoam, food in styrofoam, and then eating it. So if there is anything, that would be the place to look. What you get here is an abstract, the very beginning, the first two paragraphs of the paper that give kind of the punchline. You sometimes can see the whole article, but that's rare. It's getting more and more common that you can see the whole article. But it would give you the bibliography, the author, and what journal is, and from there you could get to the whole article. But often the abstract is very informative as well. Yes, start here and work backwards.
So. Well, and I think another solution is most of us don't have time to go to the scientific article every time we hear about one of these scary things in the paper, is to just use some common sense about being careful about what we ingest. If you look at a styrofoam container after it's been in the microwave, it's changed. And you can see it's kind of shriveled up and something's been released.
So chemical reactions have happened in that styrofoam.
So you know there's been a chemical reaction. If there's been a chemical reaction, you had food in it, it's very possible those chemicals are in there. And since you don't know, prudence would tell one that's maybe not the safest thing to microwave in. So maybe something that doesn't break down, like glass, would be better.
Yeah.
So I think sometimes
common
just
sense.
Moderation.
Yep. Yes,
using
ma'am.
Your own common sense.
You made a comparison between Japan and the United States, and I was wondering if you have any information about cancer rates in third world countries.
I don't have that with me now. That was the information from the Japan U.S. was from a textbook. That I don't have with me either. I brought that as an illustration. But it shouldn't be that hard to find that sort of information. But I'm sorry, I don't have it here.
It's just interesting that viruses are so prevalent.
Yeah, a lot less vaccination has happened so far there, and so people do get...
That's right. But I haven't read much about cancer rates.
Yeah. It might be that we're not detecting them very well either. We need to boost medicine in other parts of the world. We've got a great machine here, maybe too good a machine of medicine here. We need to get it spread out. Yes, sir.
Have you studied the toxins from the other types of cells, like bacteria cells, the toxins off the bacteria and their relationship to cancer? Like
no.
Different cultures of bacteria in your intestinal tract would be better, less toxic to your body than...
Yeah, there could be something there. I don't know anything about that. Yep.
I think the data on cancer rates in third world countries are very difficult because their lifespans are typically much shorter, and so they don't tend to develop a tumor. Plus, like you said, record keeping isn't the greatest. And I was going to piggyback a little bit on what this woman is asking about food. you know, Americans are funny critters because we come up with, and you were, I think you were going to launch into your antioxidant thing. You were tempted to.
A little bit.
But we hear that word antioxidants all the time, and they find a chemical that they suspect is taking care of these nasty free radicals in the cell. And what do they do in America? They put it in a pill. And so we can just take a pill for this antioxidant that's going to prevent cancer. Well, the pill has this chemical in it that probably came from a plant, some green leafy vegetable that we're all supposed to eat. But it's one chemical from that particular plant, and who knows what the interactions are with all the chemicals in that plant when you ingest it. See, we don't want to eat kale, but we want to eat some tasteless magic pill that's going to cure cancer for us. Well, there is no arguing that the rate of certain cancers is, in countries where they do consume mostly vegetables, is incredibly low. And in the United States, one of our highest incidents of cancer is colon cancer, because and that's a dietary,
strong dietary,
that's a hereditary thing to it too. But
Americans
are funny creatures, because we are looking for one magic thing, whether it be in a vitamin magazine or at the Mega World or whatever it is that you buy your vitamin. But the antioxidant thing is very promising if they can. If you couple it with a whole bunch of stuff, I think. But
yeah, you're right. We do have a culture in this country that may lead us to more cancer. You know, fast food in great amounts.
But I took the pill.
Yeah.
I ate a Big Mac and fries, but I took my pill this morning. So.
Yes.
I worked on farms for about 15 years, and I was exposed to a lot of chemicals, and I developed on my arm, and I was really reluctant to go in and have surgery, so I was reading a book by a doctor, his name's Andrew Weil. He wrote a book called Spontaneous Healing, and I called his secretary, and she said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I think I'd rather just take care of it myself. And she said, well, there's a salve that you can use that you can put on there that will remove it. And it's, you'll have to call this woman in New Mexico who makes it. And so I called her, and I said, well, how do I know this isn't going to attack the rest of my body if I use it? And she said, it's the salve differentiates between healthy cells and abnormal cells, and it'll only kill what's abnormal. She just said, make sure you have some aspirin on hand, because it's extremely painful if you're going to remove it yourself. And I found that it worked. And in the process of getting to know her, I found out about a man. His name is Hoxie. He used to work in the United States. He cured a lot of people from cancer. He had almost a 90% success rate when the other doctors gave up. But the AMA forced him out of the country, and his clinics are in Mexico now. And I looked at his protocol, and if you go there and stay in the clinic, you have to adhere to some certain rules, and one of them is you have to give up processed foods. You have to give up any food that's chemically grown. You have to take this tonic for the rest of your life after a year when you leave the clinic. But I do know a woman that went down there and lived for a year. The doctors gave up on her. They gave her 2 months to live, and she's in her 90s now, and she's totally cancer-free. And he did it all herbally. I was really, really amazed at some of the alternatives that are out there.
And a few years ago, in response to both this sort of thing and to the understanding that other cultures have had different practices that seem to work, the NIH was forced by legislatures to open up a section of alternative medicine research. And I think it was a good step for our country to look at other ways besides the normal ways that are being used. And that would be another place that you could look at NIH as to what's going on. And we're starting to fund you know, some work on acupuncture and some work on philosophy and healing and religion and healing and things like that. And it's a good thing that we keep our minds open and look at what's going on. It's hard for us when we don't have evidence, when there isn't good data as to how things are working. But sometimes they work, and we need to find out why. Yes.
Working with anthropologists, I read an article where the Native Americans getting their permission to dig their graves up and say, okay, that person had a tumor here, that one didn't, and so forth, and getting regions from North America, and they found a larch tree in Montana that produced about 90% of this arabinogalactin, and everyone that traded with those American Indians had very few tumors, and then right across the Cascades, there's 150 tribes in our area in Seattle, they were full of tumors. So anywhere there was a geographical border where they didn't trade with the people with that larch tree, and now they're selling that, and it is they have 10,000 clinical studies, or patients. That's one of them that was on the
yeah.
NIH.
Yeah. Well, do we need to move on to other places? One more question, yes.
Okay, before we finish, being we're talking about vocation and callings,
yep.
Can we find out how you got where you are?
Oh, how I stumbled on my life path. Well, I went to college and I studied biology and history, and I thought they were both fascinating. And I decided I wanted to keep learning, and so I applied to graduate schools in biology. And I was at Loras College in Dubuque, and then I went to Iowa State and got a PhD in molecular cellular biology. And I studied heat shock during my PhD, so the response that cells have to higher temperature that isn't lethal, and how we change what genes we use. And then I was a postdoc at Cornell University, and I studied gene expression there as well. And then I was lucky enough to find a job at a small school. I made a decision at the end of the postdoc that I didn't want to do research 100% of the time, but that I wanted to do research and teach. And that's what you can do with these small schools in this country. And I found that to be very satisfying, and it's been wonderful to work at a small school and work with students who are so excited about learning as well. And I love being on a campus. And this is a campus here. And what I like about being on a campus is that everybody who's there is interested in learning and becoming better. And that's what this place is, too. It's a slower pace. There's no exams, I've noticed. That takes some of the fun out of it, but probably lowers the stress level as well. But, so it's been fun, but I didn't know along the way what I was going to do. I didn't know when I was 10, and some people do, but I had no idea. I just kept sort of making decisions one at a time as they had to be made. I didn't make them before that. Well, thank you all.
Thank you.